right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a hell of a show for you today. Yeah, we're packing it in today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with rock photographer extraordinaire Danny Clinch about his new book, an extraordinary new book called Still Moving. All right, Danny Clinch, Still Moving. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with Jerry Lemke. He's the author of Spitting Image, which is a book that actually tore apart the myth that Vietnam vets were vilified, were assaulted, were attacked by the anti-war movement, and the way it's being resurrected, that whole image of the assault on vets being resurrected today. All right, so Jerry will be joining us in the middle of the show. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix. Carl Dix is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's also a founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Well, thinking about this, and I was watching all this, and I've seen, you know, the news that's been coming up and the way that there's a constant sort of a beating of the drums in a certain sense, but you actually, in a certain sense, you have to really look at what's going on. And right now, it's more than 3 months since Michael Brown was killed. And still, the cop that killed him walks free. And there was something that was in on the RevCom.us site that really grabbed my heart. It said it took Darren Wilson 30 seconds to pump 6 shots into Michael Brown. It shouldn't take any longer than that to indict him, yet still the process drags out. This is letting the system work. Let's talk about what's going on. Where do things stand in Ferguson right now?
Well, where things stand in Ferguson is that you have the authorities drumming in a message of we are prepared to crush anybody who stands up in protest at the decision that this grand jury comes out with that they're promising will happen somewhere from mid to late November. And that point that you made about how long it took Darren Wilson to murder Michael Brown versus how long it's taking for this grand jury to investigate that murder is very much to the point, because here you have a situation of an unarmed man who was running away from a police officer who was shooting at him, and who there are numerous eyewitnesses say he stopped, turned around, and raised his hands in surrender, and the cop blew him away. Why was there even a need to investigate this? You know who the perpetrator is. You have an abundance of evidence that it was a cold-blooded murder. The man should have been arrested and indicted on the spot, not some lengthy investigation. And the investigation is really aimed at justifying letting another killer cop go. That's the only thing that I can see in this. And then you have the authorities, like Governor Nixon holds a press conference and talks about how violence will not be tolerated. Well, is he talking about the violence of a cop gunning down an unarmed black youth? No, that violence will be tolerated, encouraged, and carried out. Is he talking about the violence that the various police departments in the St. Louis area unleashed against the protesters, the rubber bullets, the tear gas, the armored personnel carriers, the sound cannons? No, again, that's violence that the system will encourage and carry out. What they are talking about is that no one will be allowed to stand up and say, this must stop in the face of police brutality and police murder. And that's a message that people, not only in Ferguson, but all across the country, have to reject and are planning to reject.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, Carl, because one of the things I've noticed, there actually is a very, you know, there's that kind of, there's two tracks going on, but they're both heading in the same direction here. You know, on the one hand, you have all these announcements. If you look on the, you know, various news services and whatnot, there's all these announcements that have come out by the powers that be in Missouri and Ferguson. The idea that, one, they've replenished, more than replenished, their supply of weaponry, of repressive weaponry, which was very interesting to me. They, you know, well, we used it all up and now we have to get more, actually much more, because we got a tense situation coming up. You know, there's that end. And then there's also this stuff of sort of telling people, I think the way that it's been put and things that you've written, that there's this idea that somehow people have to police themselves and to actually make sure that things don't get out of hand. And it's related to what you were just speaking about.
Yes. I mean, here you have a situation where they're talking about the weaponry military style that is being supplied to these police departments. They're talking about how the National Guard is going to be mobilized in advance of the decision. All of this is being put out. Then at the same time, there's the talk about, well, the protesters have to keep themselves under control. They get endless messages that they must remain calm, that they must stay within the boundaries. And it is a very stark message when you see, well, what are the boundaries on the authorities? What are the boundaries that the police are not supposed to go beyond? And one thing that underscores this is that in the 3 months since Michael Brown was murdered by Darren Wilson, Brother Kajimi Powell in St. Louis, a mentally challenged young man who was armed with nothing more than a butter knife, was gunned down by two St. Louis police officers. Von Derek Myers was gunned down by an off-duty cop who pulled a pedestrian stop while he was off duty on several black youth, including Myers, who were just hanging out near a mall, pursued them, and shot one of them to death. Those two murders aren't even being investigated. These killings are good kills, justifiable homicide, ruled right away by the system. They are telling us that the lives of black and Latino youth are meaningless in this system, in this society, and that we have to accept that message. And like I said, there are already plans for people to respond to the grand jury, not only by taking to the streets in Ferguson, but in about 50 cities across the country, there are plans for people to take to the streets in response. And that's just the places that have already publicized and sent in their information so that it could be collected.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about Ferguson and what's shaping up there. Now, Carl, one of the things, a very important point you were just raising, because you've argued that there has to be both, if they come out with an indictment, if they come out with sort of a declaration that he's not going to be indicted, or if they come out with an indictment, there has to be a response from people in both ways. And you talked about if there's not an indictment, there has to be a very powerful no expressed. And then you said, but at the same time, there has to be a yes expressed too.
Yes, because we have to say that it is unacceptable that police are allowed to brutalize and murder people wantonly and not be punished for that. But we also have to say that we are building a movement that's going to stop this, not just around the particular murder of Michael Brown, as outrageous as that is, but that this is something that must stop. And that's why Travis and Morales and myself issued that call for people to be out in the streets. And part of the reason to be out in the streets, no matter what the decision is that, look, it is absolutely unacceptable if they let this cop walk. But at the same time, even if they indict him, we still have to be out in the streets, because we need to remember that George Zimmerman was indicted for the murder of Trayvon Martin. But then in a court case where the prosecutors were so adept at running black and Latino people into prison, forgot how to prosecute, and that murderer got to walk free. The police murderers of Sean Bell and Amadou Diallo got put on trial. They were rare cops who got put on trial for murdering black people. But again, the prosecutors forgot how to prosecute. So we have to be in the streets saying that we are standing up to say no more to police murder, no more to the criminalization of a whole generation of youth. We have to build a movement of resistance that can stop this. And at the same time, look, this stuff is built into the fabric of this system. That's something that I've learned in my decades of experience dealing with this issue, among the other issues that I've dealt with as a revolutionary communist leader. And it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to get rid of this horror of police murder and all the other horrors the system brings down on people here and all over the planet. Mm-hmm. And that's what's needed. That's what we have to be grappling with.
Carl, one more question. We'll do this real quick because, you know, as you're talking, I kept thinking about a point that you've made in numerous articles that you've written. It's been made on revcom.us a lot. The idea that now is the time to prepare. And it's, in a sense, it's both. It's yes, it's in, it's related to the what's going on in Ferguson and what that concentrates about what's happening in society at large. And it's also related to the bigger question as well. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people look at the question of revolution as something, well, how could that happen? Other people are like, well, I'm going to wait until it's time and then I'll jump in. And the point is, if we're not acting now, if we're not building resistance, if we're not spreading the need for and the possibility of revolution everywhere, things will never get to the point where it would be possible to make an attempt to make revolution and get rid of the society once and for all. And that preparation actually involves resisting the many horrors that the system is bringing down. And as we resist getting into the question of what's needed to end this once and for all, revolution nothing less, how that could be brought about, and what kind of world could be brought into being through revolution, people need to really be grappling with, well, there should be a world where those entrusted with public security would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. But to bring that kind of world into being is definitely going to take a revolution.
The conversation we've just been having with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network was pre-recorded, and shortly after we finished, the governor of Missouri announced that he was activating the National Guard and declaring a state of emergency in preparation for what promises to be a very volatile decision coming from the grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri, about whether or not to indict the killer cop, Darren Wilson, for murdering Michael Brown. Carl came back to talk with us about his take on that. Carl, what do you think about that?
Well, this just underscores what has been clear from the beginning, and that is that for the authorities, the problem is that people stood up and resisted, poured into the streets in Ferguson and around the country, stood in solidarity with them, saying no more to police murder of black youth, no more to cops gunning down our youth and getting away with it. That's been the problem for the authorities all along. And we have to be clear on that and get that for us and for humanity, the problem is that this system has its cops out there as frontline enforcers, brutalizing and murdering people on the bottom of society, and that this must stop. And that's the stance that we have to take in the face of this. All indications are that the authorities are pretty clear that they're going to let this cop walk again, the way that they have let so many other killer cops walk previously. And we have to be prepared to say this is unacceptable.
Let me ask you this, Carl, real quick, because one of the things that the governor is saying is that, and all the authorities are saying, both in Missouri and outside of Missouri, probably all the way up through the White House, saying things like, well, this is just meant to guarantee that people will have the right to exercise their right to a protest.
Well, yes, but we have to look at what they did before when people exercised their right and their responsibility to say that murder of black youth is not acceptable. They brought out police departments from various localities armed with tear gas, rubber bullets, military assault weapons, sound cannons, armored personnel carriers, and attempted to crush people standing up. Then for this time around, they've made a point about how they have upped their level of armament, upped their level of preparation. And what they're saying is, you can come out and register that you don't like us gunning you down, but we are going to set the limits on how you can express that dislike of what we can do. And if we think you go up to those limits, we're ready to crush you.
So you say about the response being what?
The response being that people have to take to the streets the moment this decision comes down. And if they let this killer cop walk, look, America's just got to be brought to a halt. It should be the case that major thoroughfares, bridges, tunnels, wherever, get blocked up. Shopping malls, what's going on there is people speaking bitterness about the murder of black youth and the allowing of the murderers to wantonly carry out that murder and go free. In St. Louis, there was a St. Louis Symphony performance in which developed in the middle of it an expression of support for Michael Brown. Those are the kind of things that need to happen everywhere. Performers need to be saying, I'm not performing tonight because I'm not with this going on. And maybe even transforming their performance into an expression of grief at the murder of Michael Brown and the outrage at the exoneration of his murderer. Professional athletes need to be taking a stand around this. All throughout the society, it's got to be coursing with murder of our youth must stop. And see, we have to view this is our youth. I don't care if you're black, white, Latino, Asian, whatever. These are our youth. This is our future, and their lives are precious. And we cannot stand by and say that it is okay or allowable that they be gunned down or that it's too confusing or murky to take a strong stand. These are our youth who are being gunned down, and it's a statement on the part of the society that it has no future for them, that it fears and hates them and is out to viciously and violently suppress them, and that can't be allowed to happen.
Now, one of the things I'll ask you, just the very last question, over and over again, you've made the point that even if there is, including in the interview we pre-recorded earlier, you made the point that even if an indictment comes down, that people still need to be in the streets. Does that still hold in terms of what you're saying in relation to, or how has it changed in relation to this idea of, you know, bring it to a halt?
Well, it definitely still holds, because as I believe we talked about before, we have to remember that George Zimmerman got indicted for murdering Trayvon. He got indicted for murder, but then they held a trial where the prosecutors, who are usually very adept at running black and Latino people into prison, forgot how to prosecute, bungled the case, and Zimmerman walked free, even though he had gunned down an unarmed black youth. So we can't say, oh, the system is working. Let's sit back and see what it does, because when we sit back and see what it does, it always produces injustice. And we need to be in the streets, whatever the verdict is. We should determine what our tactics and our mood needs to be based upon what comes out of the grand jury. If this cop walks, America must be brought to a halt. If they indict him, we have to look at what they indict him for, because this was no negligent homicide, accidental killing, manslaughter, whatever. This was a cop pursuing, shooting at, and blowing away an unarmed black youth, a youth he knew was unarmed. That comes down to nothing short of murder, and that's how it's got to be gone at. We get into this quite a bit on the website revcom.us, and I would encourage your audience to check out a piece that I wrote, but also other writings on that site, and also to go to the website stopmassincarceration.net for plans being made to respond to the verdict and to carry the movement of resistance to mass incarceration and police terror forward in the weeks and months to come, because this is not a one-day affair. It's not like we're going to respond to the grand jury, it's over for a day or two, and then it's over and we're satisfied with ourselves. We have to forge a movement that can stop these horrors.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care. Talk to you again soon. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jerry Lemke about what the hell's going on with all this resurrection of the spitting on veterans and the whole myth that's been promoted around that. So stay tuned.
There's no rest at war for a soldier, day and night, day and night. watching mothers in foreign lands. Lord, I don't fear the pain, just don't let me go insane. And only dust, 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 and the clatter of the boots. There's no rest at war for a soldier.
All right, welcome back. And that was Mark Allman with Day and Night, all right? And there's a long story behind that album. It's Orpheus in Exile, and it's the songs of, I think it's Vladimir Posner, who was a singer in the Soviet Union when it was a socialist country way back when, all right? And it was a very impressive album. I really like it a lot. Well, joining us now is Jerry Lemke, and Jerry Lemke is an interesting guy. He's the author of the book, The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. He's the Associate Professor of Emeritus of Sociology at the College of the Holy Cross and author of The Spitting Image, as I said. And he's recently written a piece. I came across this piece and I thought, wow, this is great. As some of you know, I worked on the film Cyrano, Sir David Zeiger's film, just did a little bit here and there, helping Dave with the film in various ways. And that's when I discovered Jerry Lemke. And I discovered him in relation to, you know, Dave had talked with Jerry about the whole mythology of veterans being spit on by the anti-war movement. And even though Jerry's written this book and there's been some places where it's come out, and many people who were involved in those times know that, you know, they can't remember quite, well, was that really true? I don't think so. And Jerry proved that actually it wasn't true, but it keeps getting resurrected. And just recently it happened in an op-ed piece by Maureen Dowd. What? Really? Maureen Dowd? Oh my God. And Jerry wrote a piece responding to that. And I have the feeling that Jerry read that and went, what the hell? Jerry, welcome to the show.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when I read it. It's why I began my piece by saying, unbelievable. That was the first word in my piece.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk about your reaction to that. Sure. What was it that you found so unbelievable there?
You know, besides what you've already said, the basic story that Vietnam veterans were treated badly by the anti-war movement, I find it quite unbelievable just as a piece of writing that in her very first paragraph she used what I think is a kind of a trope in that way, that she had had a flashback. She had a flashback to a time in Vietnam when Vietnam vets were greeted with placards reading baby killer and things like that. Within three, four, five sentences, she had invoked all of these kind of cliched images of the war years and of the anti-war movement. And I just found it a very poor piece of writing, for one thing, but also at this sort of late date in time, when several other news people have acknowledged that this is a myth, that is the spitting stories are myths, and they don't use these anymore, that here Maureen Dowd, this, you know, very prominent columnist for the New York Times, sort of trots this out once again, and I thought it deserved a response.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did. I want to know something, though. Why do you think this keeps coming out like this? I mean, it gets resurrected time and time again.
The best answer is that it's a myth, and myths have a certain power on the emotions of people. They're not very vulnerable to objective, you know, rejection or refutation. They tug at the heartstrings. They tug at the emotions, and so they're enduring. That's one of the things that makes them a myth. One of the things that this story does is that it changes the subject from the war itself to the people that fought the war. We don't talk about the war in Vietnam much anymore, but we talk a lot about what happened to these poor boys when they came home. I'm one of them, by the way. I was in Vietnam in 1969. The other thing it does then, by treating Vietnam veterans and veterans of the wars today the same way veterans of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, by treating them as victims of the war, it's a way of depoliticizing, or another set of words is psychologizing the political, psychologizing what could be the political in their experience. So rather than engaging war veterans today on the politics, the economics of the war itself, the culture of the military, we talk to them, about their own experience in war, and not even so much their experience, their military experience, but how they experienced it emotionally and how they're feeling about that today. It's a way, again, of changing the subject, of keeping us off what I think we should be talking about, is the politics, economics, culture of these wars themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get into all of that in a minute. But I also want to find out, people should know, you didn't actually say, you know, look, this didn't happen to me. And that, so therefore, it didn't happen. You actually did extensive research into this in terms of, was there any evidence at all for any of the things that were run out in relation to sort of the population at large, but particularly the anti-war movement, having bad relations with or attacking or assaulting returning vets? You make a lot of important points that you dug out as evidence. There's no evidence that that happened. Instead, there's evidence in the opposite direction.
Right. There's no evidence that it happened. Important for me to say that I can't prove the negative. I can't prove that it didn't happen. But I can say that there's no evidence that it ever did happen. And there is plenty of evidence that the anti-war movement reached out to, particularly to Vietnam veterans, and today again with the veterans of our current wars, reaching out to them to recruit them, try to recruit them to the anti-war movement itself. So there was a lot of mutuality and solidarity, actually, between the anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s and Vietnam veterans. And Vietnam veterans responded to that quite positively. I, like many others, actually came home from Vietnam. I came home from Vietnam early in 1970, and I came home looking for the anti-war movement, not to avoid it, but to join it, to get involved in it. And that's documentable, like you say. That can be proven. And again, in your lead-in, you referred to the film Sir, No Sir, which is a film about that and about the resistance of soldiers actually in Vietnam even to the war effort.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting because that's one of the few films that actually tells that there was, you know, Winter Soldier hearings back then, and there's some, you know, about what happened in Vietnam. But there's also, you make the point that in the creation of this cultural myth, and we'll get into the purpose for this myth very soon, but you make the point that all kinds of different elements of the superstructure were brought into this, including very massively films, which I hadn't really even thought of in terms of the kind of need to create that kind of atmosphere over the years immediately following the decade, immediately following the Vietnam War and going into the 1980s, that these films came and sort of created a whole new vision or idea of what was going on 10 years earlier.
Sure. What the films were very important for, the Hollywood films, is really constructing in the public mind this image of victim veterans, veterans who were not even primarily victimized by the war itself, but more victimized by what they encountered when they came home. So there are lots of films that have lines in them, such as coming home was the real war, coming home was the hard part. The guys, one film, I can't remember the title of it again, but the guy says, the guys that we left behind over there, they're the lucky ones. As if coming home was the real war. So we have a lot of films like that. There are almost no positive images, no images of healthy Vietnam veterans in Hollywood films. For that book, The Spitting Image, that came out in 1998, I looked at about 100 films with images of Vietnam veterans, and nary a one of those images is what you would say would be a healthy image. So that was... that's kind of then what got fixed in American memory, in American popular culture, and that's what goes forward into the present. And that's the image that younger people then grew up with leading up to the first Persian Gulf War in 1990, and then later the invasion of Iraq in 2003. These people went off to the war in Iraq with an image in their mind of what it means to come home from war. What do the American people expect you to look like, to act like, to be talking about? How do you present yourself as a veteran when you come home? And that's the kind of imagery that they had. And sure enough, predictably, that's then what we began to get a lot of when people began coming back from the Middle East.
We're talking with Jerry Lemke, an associate professor emeritus of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross and author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam and PTSD, Diagnosis or Identity in Post-Empire America. Let's talk about PTSD for a minute, post-traumatic stress syndrome. How does that fit into all this?
Fits very well with the spitting stories. Both of them, again, are about war veterans as victims. Rather than war veterans as people who were empowered and politicized by their wartime experience and have come home or could have come home. In the case of Vietnam veterans, a lot of us did come home ready to kick ass and help end the war, to really go after the politicians and to make war against the war makers. And, you know, I can talk about myself as really having kind of come into political consciousness as a result of my war experience. And I think that was true of a lot of people in Vietnam. I think that would have been true, it certainly is true, of some people who have come home from Iraq and from Afghanistan. Iraq Veterans Against the War has really made a noble fight to rebuild that anti-war movement among this generation of veterans. But it's been really, really hard because there is a kind of stigmatizing of war veterans, because of the stigmatizing of Vietnam veterans as kind of whacked out head cases. Again, that's the imagery that comes across through Hollywood films, and it gets mushed together with the images of anti-war veterans. To the extent that we see images of anti-war veterans in films, it's also smushed together with pathologized, kind of psychologized, medicalized images of war veterans. So what I think is that this current generation of veterans see the stigma in that, and there is a reluctance to come out politically, lest you be then categorized as hurt, as psychologically wounded, as your behavior then being psychologized, being medicalized, and the public consciousness then takes you down that path, and you don't want to go down that path. So the safest thing maybe is to keep your mouth shut, come home, go back to school, go back to work, go back to friends and family, and don't come out politically. I think that's a huge part of what's going on in our political culture today.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things that you pointed out, and I think it's really important that where we're heading with this discussion, because one of the things that you pointed out at the beginning, and you also point out in your article, that there's something big going on in terms of a shifting or in terms of a push right now in relation to veterans, in relation to soldiers in the world. And Maureen Dowd's piece was actually a big part of that, and including the Concert for Valor that just occurred on the Mall. I don't know if you saw in Washington, D.C. I don't know if you looked.
I wish I could say I did, but I thought of it. I knew it was going to be on HBO, and I thought it would be on some other cable channels, too. I could swear I saw or heard that someplace, but then, you know, the night it aired, I couldn't find it. I don't subscribe to HBO, and it was too late for me to do that. So, but go ahead with your question.
Well, just the point that, you know, one of the things that was really dramatic to me in terms of the volume of the American flags and American mm-hmm. flags being people dressed, painted in red, white, and blue, and stars, and wearing flags as, you know, shirts, and just incredible, just really one. If you have any sense at all about the world and what's going on in the world right now, this rush to this sort of like insane, mindless patriotism was just yep. concentrated so heavily in that.
Well, it's a patriotism that's all filtered through the war veteran stuff, the veteran stuff. It's kind of distorted, I think, by that. And by the way, this HBO program this year was a kind of a sequel to the one that was done, I think, maybe 2 years ago. HBO did one, a Veterans Day. It wasn't a Capitol Mall kind of thing like this one was, but I wrote about the one that was 2 or 3 years ago. I write about that in my new book, PTSD, the book that you just mentioned. I write quite a bit about that, in fact, so I would like listeners to know about that. And a lot of it, my critique of that, and it would certainly be my critique of this one, is that it's the commercialization of Vietnam, of veterans. It's a commercialization of veterans and a commercialization of the hurt veteran imagery. The idea that we need to be sympathetic to these people because they've come home with PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and so forth. And I think it's a very distasteful commercialization attempt to create good PR, in this case for Starbucks, was one of the big-time sponsors of this event, and it creates nice PR. Here you have Starbucks doing something nice, right, for war veterans by having this thing on the Capitol Mall. I think the whole thing is, as I say, distasteful.
Yeah, it reminds me of Wallace Shawn's comment about once he learned about coffee and where it came from and how it was picked and processed, that every time he went into a McDonald's to get a cup of coffee, he looked at a cup of blood in his hand, right? And, you know, you're looking at this and you're thinking about, you know, I'm thinking about a point you made also. I can't remember whether it was in this article or somewhere else, but you made this point about this sort of commercialization is one thing of the soldier, of the vet, but there's also this thing of in a country, in a world that's actually in the shape that this one is right now and where things seem to be snowballing towards, the idea that there's the misused, the sort of abused veterans, the soldiers haven't gotten their due, you know, and the idea you point out there that was actually one of the things that the Nazis used to rally people around their immense patriotic fervor to go and conquer the world under their program. And I keep thinking about that point and in relation to what you said earlier about, look, you know, that we're not having the conversation we need to be having. We're having a conversation that's being shaped and put out there by these other forces that have bigger, more wicked interests in the world.
Well, that really goes to the heart of the matter. And again, that's where my book, the PTSD book, goes. Look, two things about the post-World War I experience in Germany. One is that the same kind of myth circulated in Germany that anti-war people, communists, Jews, women, particularly women, were hostile to German veterans when they came back. Spitting is alleged to have happened in Germany after World War I. There are stories about that. And just like in the United States, it's alleged to have been women who were oftentimes the spitters. So that I've written quite a bit about that, about those spitting stories. But it's also true in Germany that shell shock was used politically in Germany. The image of shell-shocked German veterans was used as a metaphor for the shell-shocked nation that needed to be healed, that needed vengeance through more war. The shell-shocked Germany, the shell-shocked populace of Germany was traumatized by the loss of the war. It had a blow to its pride by the loss of the war, and all of those things needed to be avenged through rearmament. Germany need to refind its pride through the remilitarization of the war, in a sense, to get back in the saddle, to get back on the horse and ride again, and to show that we are the right stuff. I think that stuff is really, really at the core of American political culture today. And the Vietnam War is at the core of the core, but these more recent wars are also going down as not only unpopular wars, but now they're going down as lost war, and they're gonna add on to that core. They're gonna make it a bigger and stronger and more dense core. And we're really heading down a road here of betrayal imagery, that the country has been betrayed, and where that turns and has already turned a little bit in this country then is like where it turned in Germany, which is a search for scapegoats internally that takes on political dimensions, it takes on racial dimensions, it takes on gender dimensions, but it could turn a lot worse in the United States if we don't sort of wake up and be aware that these things are at work. They work on us not so much cognitively. If we were aware of them, they wouldn't work, but they work on us subconsciously. They work on us in ways that we're not aware.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jerry, we're going to have to wrap it up for today, but I am going to have you back to talk about your new book very soon, okay?
Okay, that'd be great.
All right, great, yeah. All right, thank you very much, and talk to you again soon.
Sure. All right, bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Jerry Lemke, who's an associate professor emeritus of sociology at the College of Holy Cross and the author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and his new book, PTSD, Diagnosis or Identity in Post-Empire America. We're going to take a quick break and be back with Danny Clinch, premier rock photographer, talking about his new book, Still Moving. That's the point. And I got mixed up on the title because it just kept getting at me, all right? So it's Danny Clinch, Still Moving, and we'll be right back to talk with Danny live. All right, welcome back. Didn't want to stop that song, all right? It's Something Wicked This Way Comes, and it's from Lucinda Williams and her new album, Down Where the Spirit Meets the Bone. And I really wanted to play that song because there was a photo in this collection, in this new book called Still Moving, Danny Clinch, Still Moving. And it was a photo of Lucinda Williams, and there were two photos that really grabbed me. One was of her sitting with her back towards the camera and in a corner, and it just captured so much. And then the next was her sitting in the back of a convertible, and all you saw was the back seat of the convertible part of it, and her leaning her head on the side of the right where the window and the rooftop joint meets, and she's just laying her head back and she's looking, and it captured and said so much. It's still talking to me, even though I'm trying to figure out exactly what it's saying inside my head. Okay, I had a chance to attend a reception, a party, for this book, for Danny Clinch's new book, Still Moving. And it was a couple weeks ago, and I was really moved by the photography I saw there. I've looked at the book. It's one of the most beautiful, most powerful books of photography I've ever seen. And it's for anyone who loves music, and anyone who loves the human spirit needs to get this book. It's a tremendous book. And Danny's joining us to talk about it today. Danny, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. And welcome to the show, man. I'm really glad to have you on.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. Where did the title come from, Still Moving?
Well, you said it. It came from you started to say it anyway. Mm-hmm. It comes from a Willie Nelson song. Still is still moving to me.
Mm-hmm. But what does it say in terms of, you know, because I was thinking about that. That still is still moving to me. It captures something about the whole what you've dedicated your life to.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's capturing a still of a moving moment, and you know, capturing it for you know that little split second where you choose to press the shutter. I think it also refers to me always being on the move and in search of the still image, and the fact also that, you know, I have morphed into a moving image filmmaker as well as a still photographer. So it just keeps building on the layers.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's very heavy because I'm going to go through some of the things, some of the sections that are in your book, which, again, the book is Still Moving, and it's from Abrams, the publisher Abrams. And I'm telling you, folks, it's really a great book. Don't miss this book. If you love music, if you love humans, if you love photography, this is a book for you, you know? And it's a season where everybody's going to be giving stuff to people. Get this book and tell them to get it for you, all right? Danny, you talk about being the photographer as a documentarian. And in some ways, people look at that as, okay, well, that, you know, you can see documentary films. You can see, you know, you can see like sort of certain kinds of pictures, photos of people's lives. But you take that to a whole other level, I think. I mean, I was watching, even looking at something with Neil Young, you know, the book opens up with Neil Young's hat on the trunk of a rusted car with real big fins, you know? And
yeah.
There's something that's captured in every one of those photos, some point that really is the photographer as a documentarian. What are you talking about there, and how did you carry that out?
You know, as a young photographer, I was really interested in the document, the photograph as a document. You know, Robert Frank, Danny Lyon, people like that. And I think, you know, it's all really visual storytelling. And I think you pointed out a good one with the hat of Neil Young sitting on the car. There's like a great little story there. You know, I feel like if you think about music and musicians and the fact that most of us use this as the soundtrack to our lives, you know, to good times and bad times, to celebrate things, to get us through hard times, it becomes a really important aspect of our life. And for me, I like to document the people that make that music. And so it's oftentimes I get to do publicity or a portrait of someone, and that's a beautiful opportunity. And then I'm also perhaps where someone's looking directly in the camera or something like that. But I'm also searching for a moment that is a little more captured and a little more different than the posed one. You know, I'm looking for the moment when they're distracted and their shoulders are down, and like sometimes it's best to just hand them an instrument, you know, whatever their instrument is, and maybe you see their whole body language change. Or, you know, I'm fine with people distracting people while I'm photographing them because it just only helps me capture a more real moment.
Huh, that's a trip. That's interesting. So I'm going to come to your next shoot and just distract the hell out of them, okay?
There Thanks.
You go. Okay. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Danny Clinch, a rock photographer extraordinaire, and we're talking about his new book, Danny Clinch, Still Moving. Well, one thing that actually related to that is you have a photo of Metallica in prison, which I was stunned by. And I have to tell you, it was the first photo that I saw when I went into the exhibition you had, the exhibit you had over at, the Morrison Hotel Gallery, right?
And the party was at the McKittrick Hotel.
Right.
At Sleep No More and Morrison Hotel Gallery. We did a gallery as well, yeah.
Right. And when I saw that, when I walked up to this photo, there was a young guy sitting there, and he was just staring at it. And he just kept staring at the photo. And I was zeroing, I was sort of stepping back and looking at Metallica and some other things. And he pointed to one face of one guy and said, look at that man's face. He's having the time of his life. And the photo, just so people understand, it's a photo of Metallica playing like on the floor. And then on top of them is the tears. And they're filled with people, all kinds of people. And anybody who knows Metallica's music and knows what those people are getting, and then you look at the what's shown in the faces and the position and the and just the body language that you captured in those prisoners was really remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, imagine having the day-to-day life that these guys have and then having the opportunity to have a band like Metallica come in there and play for you and change the the routine, your dull routine, I would imagine your dull routine of and being a chance, you know, having a chance to sort of forget your troubles for a second there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's interesting because it you know you had the you had the way you have it set up too. You have Metallica, which they're in the process of going into the prison at one photo. Then you have the concert actually taking place. And, you know, it's not what people normally look at when think of when they think of a concert in a prison. And then you have this picture of people, these guys in the yard. And the way that they're cheering, and it was just a remarkable story, right, just in those three photos.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's the power of the document. You can make your own story up, and some will be a lot different, and some will be the same.
Now, you say, too, that you like to not just take the photo yourself, but you actually like to participate, make it so that the subject that you're taking pictures of actually becomes part of the process, and that they participate in the process so that it becomes a real collaboration. And that requires a certain amount of intimacy and trust. And let's talk about that a little.
I guess for me, there are many different ways to approach the photo shoot. Some people have very distinct ideas that they don't want anybody getting in the way of their ideas. They want to really focus, and I'm coming for this, and I know this is what I'm going to get, and I'm going to be happy with it. And me, I like to keep my eyes open, and I like to keep my ideas open, and I certainly prepare every time I go to a photo shoot. But what I'm hoping is going to happen is that everything that I prepared can go out the window because I found something better. You know, I've come in and I've responded to the lighting somewhere or the location or just the way the person's acting. And then I sort of take that and incorporate it and bring it into the process. And then, like you said, and I've said many times, is that it becomes a collaboration between the two of us, and it's not my forced opinion of who this person is. You know, and every shoot's different. Sometimes it's just me and my Leica, and other times it's me and a small crew, you know, going in and trying to accomplish a bigger thing like album packaging and publicity and, you know, or a magazine cover, which is more simple than, you know, than a cluttered documentary-style photograph. So, you know, everything brings its different challenges, and I just try to embrace them.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the people that figures largely in the book is Springsteen. And yeah. Bruce did the introduction to the book or the forward to the book. And he basically laid out something that I thought related to this was very heavy because he talked about his interaction with you and how you both seemed to share the same experiences and the same dreams. And in a sense that made it much easier for him to actually open up and work with you like that.
Yeah, we're really from the same area. I grew up in New Jersey, just about 30 minutes south of him. And funny enough, my dad, who is actually in one of the photographs with Bruce in the back of that car, you know, my dad grew up really like the next town over. He grew up in Wall Township, New Jersey, and Bruce, of course, in the Freehold area. And there's just a lot of similarities between where he grew up, where I grew up, and where my dad grew up. And we found out recently, I think, that his dad worked in a plastics factory at some point in his life as part of his career, and my dad actually worked in a plastics factory. It's just like the similarities are really interesting. And so we just kind of bonded on that fact that we were from the same area, and, you know, we were lovers of music and film, and that we always had something to talk about, you know. And I was pretty much embedded in the music community, and I was listening to things that he wasn't listening to, and he was listening to things I wasn't listening to, and his kids were bringing music into the fold, and he would say to me, have you heard this band? Because my son's listening to it. Huh. And we would just, you know, it just became always a great hang. And again, he's a guy who's a great collaborator, and he participates in the shoots, and he's not afraid to give his opinion and to help present himself in a way that just makes everything that much better.
Mm-hmm. You know, you also talk about doing portraits, and I was really amazed by that, by the take you have on that. And you said, you know, because I'm looking at it, you said that sometimes you realize that you don't necessarily have to show the face in a portrait. And you have examples of that. You have Dylan looking out a window. You have, you know, all the ones that really just fascinated me was like the one where you have Springsteen looking at a still empty stadium where he's about to perform, or you have Neil Young, you know, in the same situation, where you have people, or you have just, you know, Dave Matthews Band, all the horns out there. And it's just, even that to me felt like a portrait of the band and of what was coming.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I appreciate you seeing that. And it is. It's like, again, it comes down to storytelling. The portrait of Leroy, who is the saxophone player for the Dave Matthews Band, the portrait of his saxophones against the skyline in New York City in Central Park is really a portrait of him, even though he's not in it. And the Dylan photo, he's looking out the window, and you see him from the back, and, I mean, you don't even have to see his face. You know it's Bob Dylan. So I feel like you don't always have to be so literal. I'm also one who likes to, I like a nice, simple, direct portrait, but I also like to pull way back and just show the atmosphere of what's going on around it.
Let me ask you about some of these that actually really, really just struck me. I got to notice, man, because I have been a Tom Waits freak forever, okay? You got some of the most amazing pictures of Tom Waits, things that, you know, when you listen to his music, you know that it's in there, but I would have never even dreamt of seeing Tom Waits up in the air with his legs and his guitar, and what was going on there, and how you got these pictures, or the thing on the merry-go-round. You know, these were things that you expect from Tom Waits, but actually capturing that was so intense, man. It was so beautiful.
Thank you. You know, again, talk about a great collaborator, Tom Waits. He always shows up with something unique, and he's got such a unique point of view on life and on photography and on creativity. And it's a great example of rolling with the punches is the shot of him on the carousel. I was all set to photograph him in San Francisco, and I was in the middle of scouting locations and where am I going to shoot him and what are we going to do. And I get a call from his publicist, and she says, listen, Tom is wondering if you would mind coming up to up to where he lives in Santa Rosa, near Santa Rosa, and go to the county fair, because he promised his son and his nephew that he would take him to the fair. You know, some people might have been like, wow, I've got this spot, and I really want him to come down to San Francisco. And me, I was like, yes, send me to the county fair with Tom Waits, please.
Yeah, right.
Pretty please. And so, you know, twist my arm, you know, myself and my buddy, my assistant at the time, Gary, we rolled up there, and of course we're big Tom Waits fans, you know, we're like, this is going to be amazing. And I said, hey, well, it's going to be great. Oh, she put me on the phone with him. So I said, oh, it's going to be great. We'll go up in the, you know, we could go up in the Ferris wheel. It'd be, what a great point of view. And he's like, oh, man, I don't know if I want to go up in the Ferris wheel. I'm afraid of heights or something like that. And I said, how about the carousel? He's like, yeah, the carousel. And, you know, he just, he bought that little plastic pistol with him, and we snuck it into the fair. And he, when he jumped on the horse, of course, he chooses that crazy dragon, sea dragon horse thing. You know, I'm thinking he's going to jump on like the classic merry-go-round guy. And he jumps on that thing. And as he comes around, he pulls out this little, you know, orange water pistol. It's just so much fun.
Yeah. We have time for one more question, Danny, and I have no idea where to go with this, except so I'm just going to pick it, okay? One of the things when you talk about the, you know, again, I'm back thinking about these portraits, and I mentioned in the beginning that Lucinda Williams, and you know, I had originally been really attracted to the one in the convertible, but then I actually saw that one with her just in a corner facing the wall that really, there was so much captured there, and I thought about that in relation to your point about you have to find the essence of people when you're taking their photographs. And you did the same thing with Buddy Guy's hands, you know, it was just really, or Patti Smith in a record shop, you know. I couldn't think of anything more fitting.
Well, so you want to hear the Patti Smith story or the Lucinda one, or should I tell them both really fast?
Tell them both really fast.
Okay. The Lucinda one, actually, like for me, she's actually very shy. And at certain points, she's very shy. And at other points, she's not shy at all. I kind of had that image of, I think I recently saw that image of like Robert Johnson. I think it was drawn by R. Crumb or something, where he's sitting in a corner with his back to everyone, and he's recording his great recordings, which were apparently happened in a hotel somewhere when they bought like one of the, one of the great documentarians would be in a hotel and they'd invite the local people to come and record a song, field recordings. And so that photo was inspired by that. And to me, it's very interesting because she looks so shy and so hidden in that photo. And I think it's quite beautiful.
Definitely, definitely.
And then the Patti Smith photo was we went to a record store shopping. I said, I want to do a portrait of you holding one of your favorite records. Now, we had already shot some of her record shopping and all that. And so I said, grab a record that you love. She grabs the Coltrane record and she says, I can never walk past this record and not buy it. If I'm at a yard sale, if I'm in a flea market, if I'm in a used record store and I see Love Supreme, I'm buying it. She said, because I can never bear to see it sitting there not being played. So I have like 6 or 7 copies of this record at home, and I'm going to buy this one too.
That's great. On that note, Danny, I think that captures everything. So, Danny, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
I appreciate your time.
All right,
man.
All right. Take
thank
care
you.
Now. Sure.
Cheers.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with photographer Danny Clinch about his new book, Still Moving. Folks, a beautiful book. You don't want to miss this. All right, that brings us to the end of another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix, Jerry Lemke, and Danny Clinch. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out now with a new piece from Jackson Browne from his new album, Standing in the Breach, and it's called Which Side?
In search of El Dorado, but you haven't found it yet. You might be an old man with his whole life at his back, and you can hear eternity whispering down the track. Or maybe you're a woman, or just about to be, and you can feel the generations swimming in your sea. But you know that it's coming, early as the dawn, a battle for the future, baby. Which side are you on? Come on, come on, come on. If you're coming, come on, come on, come on. Come on, come on, come on. If you're coming, which side are you on? Come on, come on, come on. If you're coming, battle lines are drawn. Come on, come on, come on. If you're coming, which side? Which side are you? Corporations attacking the natural world, drilling and fracking.